Over to Justice Pickering.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. I'm here with Justice Kadish, my co-petitioner on this matter. It is a proposed amendment to Model Rule 1.8E. And for those of you who are model rule buffs, you probably already know what 1.8E says, but if you're not, I'll give you some background. It prohibits lawyers from giving money to clients, and it's born of the old prohibition against champerty and maintenance. And so it has a long and storied history in the common law, and gets put into our model rules. The ABA has promulgated an amendment to it because, read literally, Model Rule 1.8E could prevent a lawyer from basic humanitarian gestures to a client, such as an indigent client who lacks bus fare to get to the courthouse or hasn't the clothes to go to court in a way that they feel comfortable with the dignity of the proceeding in presenting themselves to a court. And so out of recognition of those needs and the humanitarian instinct that we all have as lawyers trying to help indigent clients, the ABA has amended the model rule, and states elsewhere have adopted it. We were really privileged by the Melanie Kushner Fellow, Kira Clark, and she presented to us a proposed amendment with the backup support, including a multi-state survey. And we were, Justice Kadish and I, probably the quickest turnaround, certainly since I've been on the court, of anything that was presented to us making its way into an 80KT petition. And so I would like to recognize and thank her and thank the Kushner Fellowship Program. This is a much needed change. It was addressed to some extent in the Nevada Lawyer or the Communique in 2021. But it didn't go anywhere at that time, and so it was with a lot of pride and interest and applause for the presentation that we filed this amendment to 445 to propose it. So with that, I'd like to ask if Justice Kadish has anything to add to my comments.
Very briefly, thanks, Justice. So the two of us are the co-chairs of the Access to Justice Commission, as probably everyone sitting in the room here knows. But I also appreciate the contributions we got, the suggestion that we got. I also note the public comments that we did receive on this. And specifically, Mr. Fiedler, on behalf of the Standing Committee on Ethics and Professional Responsibility, has made a couple of recommendations as to the proposed rule, in line with the model rule that was adopted by the ABA. So perhaps that can be arranged when we have some of you come up and discuss whether you would agree to that or you don't, and why. But other than that, I don't need to take any more time right this second. Yeah,
there is one divergence between our draft and some of the comments we received, and I neglected to mention them, but I'd be interested, and I think my colleagues would. The model is the client needs to be indigent, the gift or support needs to be modest, and they can't be extended or conferred with an expectation of repayment by the client. But there's a question of whether it should be limited to pro bono clients who are involved in an existing legal aid service organization, or it could extend as well to lawyers providing services free of charge on their own outside and not under the auspices of a formal pro bono legal aid legal services provider. So I just noted that in preparing for today, and that is something that I think we'll have to resolve among ourselves, but we'd welcome the opportunity to hear from you and the rationale for one rule or the other and which is better. So with that, do you want to call for the comments?
Yes, please. If any members of the public wish to speak to this 80KT, please come forward in Las Vegas.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Kira Clark, and I'm a 2L at UNLV William S. Boyd School of Law. Honorable Justices, I'm very grateful for the opportunity to speak on the proposed amendment to NRPC 1.8 this afternoon. Over the summer, I had the privilege of carrying on Melanie Kushner's legacy as Melanie Kushner Access to Justice Fellow at the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada. As part of being the Melanie Kushner Fellow, you design a project that focuses on access to justice. My project proposal was increasing access to justice by increasing access to transportation. My hope was to create a public and private partnership with various stakeholders, including RTC, Uber, and Lyft, to address the challenge of our indigent clients traveling hours to meet in person with their attorneys. Instead of our clients waiting hours for a bus to arrive, an attorney could schedule a car to pick them up, and the rides would be sponsored by private donors, potentially. Unfortunately, my idea came across a roadblock, NRPC 1.8E. The ABA, as you noted, and several other states have recognized the limitations of this rule and have introduced exceptions. Our initial proposed amendment to this rule would enable nonprofit legal service providers to offer or facilitate modest financial assistance benefiting thousands of Nevadans. To briefly address the State Bar of Nevada Standing Committee on Ethics and Professional Responsibility, there are proposed three additions to our initial proposal. To address the first addition, the three restrictions mentioned, justices, we think that including these restrictions are not necessary, especially in regards to restriction number three, may not publicize or advertise a willingness to provide such a gift to prospective clients. So in this case, could I not ask Uber or Lyft to donate a ride to our clients? We see that these restrictions are not worth implementing. To address the second addition with the two words pro bono, we see the words pro bono apply to private practice attorneys taking on cases for free. We don't see this as applicable for legal aid attorneys here. And to address the third addition, we do not support the change of adding the language for basic living expenses because it is too limiting. This could create confusion on what we are trying to do. For example, we would like to work with transportation companies like rideshare, companies like Uber and Lyft. There might be a question as if those are basic living expenses or not. And also under basic living expenses for Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada specifically, if for basic living expenses, should we go through, for example, another nonprofit to provide funds to give a child a second set of glasses if they break their only set of glasses under Medicaid? So are these sets, is this set of glasses covered under basic living expenses like food, shelter, water? It creates too much confusion. So we went through every state's 1.8E exceptions, as you have noted, to try and tailor it to Nevada and to not include any unnecessary language that would make this less easy to understand. In conclusion, legal aid providers in Nevada are hopeful that this court will pave a smoother path for our clients by modifying NRPC 1.8E. This amendment will not only enhance access to justice, but also empower our legal service providers to better serve our community. Thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Clark. Does anybody have any questions for Ms. Clark since she's up here? Ms. Clark, I have a question.
Yes.
Justice Pickering touched upon it. Can you think of any principled reason why we wouldn't allow any lawyer to provide humanitarian services or things of the nature that we're discussing here, limited to legal aid?
Limited to legal aid, no. This exception is for legal aid service providers. So,
right. Can you think of any principled reason why it should only be for legal aid providers? Shouldn't every lawyer be allowed to be human and kind and helpful to indigents, clients, as they may be?
Yes, but if a private practice attorney takes this too far by financially assisting clients in the course of a trial, that's a whole other consideration that can go out of hand really quickly and can lead to a lot more issues down the line.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Anyone else have any questions? Not so quickly.
Okay.
Right. Get your money's worth today. anyone else have any questions for Ms. Clark? Ms. Gaddish?
Good afternoon. Happy to see you.
Good afternoon. Nice to see you.
So let me just clarify as to some of the responses you had to some of the changes proposed based on the model rules. So there were three potential restrictions that were listed in Mr. Fiedler's letter on the second page of his letter. And I heard you say, I think, that you were not in favor of the third one, which suggests a restriction that you may not publicize or advertise a willingness to provide such gifts to prospective clients, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And I'm not sure, and maybe I missed it, and if so, I apologize. As to the first two listed there, would those restrictions be appropriate?
We find that they're not necessary because we do not see legal aid attorneys. It wouldn't be applicable to them for retaining a client or inducing a client-lawyer relationship for the first one. And the second one, legal aid attorneys, it's obviously under the ethics of the rules as well, cannot seek reimbursement.
Right. Okay. Yeah. It's just not applicable in that circumstance. And then I think what you're getting at as to one of the other proposed changes is that adding the words pro bono on nonprofit legal services provider, is it just like not needed in that context? Is that your idea?
That's correct. And a lot of legal aid attorneys do not see themselves as pro bono attorneys. So adding that language is not necessary.
Can you explain? Sorry.
Yeah, so legal aid attorneys are staff attorneys. So they're already employed by legal aid of Southern Nevada. So when you think of
the pro bono attorneys are the people out in the community that they may pass a case, that the legal aid provider may pass a case on too.
Correct.
Got it. Thank you.
I do have one question. So you took some issue with the word for basic living expenses, and I can understand, you know, a child's glasses, second pair of glasses, you need to get those reimbursed. But do you think by having the language and humanitarian aid kind of cures and broadens the scope of just living expenses, basic living expenses?
If you look to our initial proposal where it just says modest financial assistance and modest gifts of humanitarian aid, we find that sufficient. If you include basic living expenses, it can get confusing, especially in regards to transportation, because is that covered under food, shelter, water, under basic expense living expenses? So that's where we find a little bit of reservation with that term.
I guess I have a question.
Certainly.
The model rule in that regard references may provide modest gifts to the client for food, rent, transportation, medicine, and other basic living expenses. So it looks as though the letter just plucked the basic living expenses out of the ABA model draft, which had the larger list that I just read to you. Do you have an objection to the larger list? Because I think what the ABA draft is trying to get at is to ensure that it is appropriately tailored to an indigent client's needs, and not something that gets into the market of trying to woo a client or encourage litigation, which is the old historical prohibition against champerty and maintenance, which is alive and well in Nevada and other settings. So could you comment on whether or not the longer list would, in your opinion, be preferable to the basic living expenses if some language were added to this rule?
We appreciate the longer list that's mentioned in the letter. But for facilitating modest gifts and humanitarian aid, we're concerned with for basic living expenses going back because under the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada, we have the Children's Attorneys Project. And a lot of those children foster care. They need things or to feel sometimes more accepted or more included into a very difficult environment that they're in. So for example, if a child needs $50 to sign up for a basketball camp, that could be potentially provided from their attorney that they're represented at the CAF attorney that they're represented by. That's where I'm concerned with this limiting. It's, while the list is expansive, it's still limiting.
Yeah, or holiday gifts and the like. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, I see your point. Thank you.
Chief, sorry, I just want to clarify following up on one of the prior conversations we had then. As drafted, which would cover lawyer representing an indigent client through a nonprofit legal service provider, is that intended to cover both those employed by the legal service provider as well as private attorneys who may take a pro bono case? Or is it just those who are employed at the legal service provider?
So the language as you've read it, it would also include pro bono attorneys.
Okay. Yeah. Right. So we wouldn't, got it. So adding the words pro bono would limit it, make it narrower than it is as drafted.
Yes.
Got it. Thank you.
All right. Anything further for Ms. Clark?
Nothing except to thank you for your initiative
yes.
on this.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, ma'am. Thanks. Is there anything in Clarkson, anybody who'd like to speak further to this in Las Vegas? Yes.
Good afternoon, Justices. My name is Diane Farron. I am the non-attorney executive director for Southern Nevada Senior Law Program. I'm here to talk about the impact of the model rule as proposed and the very diligent work of the committee, the two commission chairs, and my colleagues from Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of the comments made by the prior presenter from Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada and to tell you a little bit about what it would mean to Senior Law Program. We serve over 2,600 seniors each year, and the average age of our client is 73. The average income is $26,000 a year. 44% of our clients identify as an ethnic minority, and 40% of our clients identify as disabled or frail. One key example of a significant impediment to accessing the legal assistance provided by Senior Law Program is the low-income senior who does not have access to reliable transportation on an always available when needed basis. 10% of our clients, we added this screening question last year when we upgraded our case management system, reply they don't have ready access to available transportation. The number of seniors we have seen arrive in our office in the 112-degree heat of a July summer who had to take more than one bus to get there, and we know what awaits them after they've met with the attorney, breaks our hearts and also prevents a number of others from ever being able to make it there and back home. In addition to which, those who have received an eviction notice and need to file a timely response often have been somewhat paralyzed when they received the 7-day notice and don't reach out to us till it's 5 days. So that person having the additional obstacle of being able to get to the courthouse once they've made it to Senior Law Program, it's exhausting and overwhelming, and this proposed rule would minimize greatly that barrier to helping those that legal aid that Senior Law Program is designed to serve. The adoption of this model rule will allow us to more holistically serve the at-risk older adults who need our assistance, and we appreciate so much your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody have any questions? No? All right, thank you, ma'am. Any additional speakers in Las Vegas? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Joshua Gilmore. I'm a partner at Bailey Kennedy and one of the members of the State Bar of Nevada Standing Committee on Ethics and Professional Responsibility. So here today on behalf of the committee to discuss a little bit our comments and support this petition. And I will start with that, right? I think from a macro perspective, the committee is in favor of the humanitarian exception, right? I think it's good to see more and more states are adopting this, right? The ABA adopting it as well with much more detailed language for better and worse, I think at times, right? We've seen that. So from the committee's perspective, when we saw this petition filed, one of our jobs, of course, is to try to contribute to professional conduct here in Nevada, give guidance to other attorneys, and speak to proposed rule amendments that come before this court. And so we took it upon ourselves at the committee to look at this and to discuss as a group and then submit comments to the court as to how we viewed the rule, right? And so in many ways, we were driven by some of the language that the ABA has already adopted, right? And so I'll speak to sort of the restrictions, you can call it, that we lay out at the top of page two of Mr. Fiedler's letter. He's our chairman, as well as some of the additional language that then we recommended that went into the rule itself, right? In terms of the restrictions, you know, we saw that as these are restrictions driven from the lawyer's perspective, right? So I know there's concern about, and if I understood, you know, Uber having the ability to advertise that they might do this for attorneys, right? This rule, of course, is only directed to what a lawyer can do as opposed to Uber. So I don't think anything would prevent, with this type of language, a company like Uber making these services available, right? It's simply a suggestion that lawyers don't have the ability to advertise that that is an option for them, right? That if you choose me as your attorney, you know, I can provide these gifts that others may or may not choose to for financial reasons or otherwise, right? Similar, I think, under not implying that this is something that you're going to do to try to entice the representation, right? I mean, I think ideally we want as many lawyers out there as we can taking pro bono cases, and I'm sure it would be the incredible exception that somebody envisions going to legal aid to get a case because they see it as a future source of business, right? But I think the idea behind the restrictions that are included in the model rule is to, we're doing this altruistically, right? That there's not secondary gain behind this. And I think these restrictions are simply reinforcing that. Certainly there's alternatives though, if we don't like it in the language of the rule. If you look at the comments to the ABA model rule, they really speak to these already, right? And I know Nevada at times we don't adopt the comments, but we look to them for guidance unless they're inconsistent with Nevada law. So just the same, we might say, well, the comments might be enough guidance for us to understand that areas for abuse won't be tolerated if we don't embody it in the plain language of the rule itself, right? The discussion about adding pro bono, you know, and I understand and quite candidly did not necessarily understand the distinction. If you're in-house at legal aid, do you not consider yourself a pro bono attorney? I would assume so. You know, I envision, you know, if you're in court at the conclusion of a case for a pro bono client, if you've prevailed, if you're a legal aid, you know, you'll still argue, hey, this is a pro bono representation that may, that doesn't limit me from seeking fees just because the client's not paying for my fees, right? Right. And that's language that the ABA also had, that in their version of the rule, which we thought by including pro bono, you then may not need that language, which is the fact that you're representing an indigent client through legal aid and perhaps supplying these gifts won't prevent you from going to court if you prevail and seeking fees if there's a contractual or statutory basis for doing so, right? So I think the pro bono from the committee's perspective is simply reinforcing that the client is not paying for this person's service. Right. And whether pro bono is the way to capture that or just, you know, listening today, whether we would say representing an indigent client pro bono or through a legal services organization, you know, something as simple as that might then capture what I think would then make sure we're distinguishing the private placements where they've gone through legal aid or Nevada legal services, as well as cases that are being handled also in-house at those same facilities. Right. There was a question about why shouldn't all lawyers be allowed to do this. Of course, I have the benefit of discussing with my committee here in real time, but I think the answer would be is there's sort of a vetting process, as I would understand it, when clients go to legal aid, right? Indigency, for example. And there's qualifications, as I understand it, that you have to meet financially to justify placement either in-house or externally. And so I think if we broaden the rule and just hoped that everybody limited it to indigent clients, you know, there's a presumption that they're going to do that. But if there's an obvious way, I think, to control it on the front end, we would welcome that sort of restriction now. And so I think limiting it to people who have qualified from the legal aid center's perspective, and I use that to capture all legal aid services, I think make sure that we know that the right clientele, the right clients are the ones receiving this aid, as opposed to others who may not qualify for indigent representation through legal aid, but has found a private attorney for one reason or another who's still willing to take that person's case. There was a discussion about gifts for basic living expenses. The committee does think it's appropriate to have some limitation on that because gifts can mean anything, right? And I think, too, we have to be mindful that the purpose behind this is glasses. I don't think anybody can argue that that's, to me, even not a living expense. And for justices here or myself with contacts, I couldn't live if I did not have glasses or contacts, right? So I think that would fit within that rubric. But I believe the idea behind the model rule and the humanitarian exception is to know that there's some limitation on that. And I would have no problem, I think, if the court said we want to use the language that the model rule has, which is, I think, giving some examples of living expenses, right? Food, rent, transportation, medicine, and other basic living expenses. I read that to say those first few are examples, but they all really fall within the basic living expenses rubric. So if we want to be short and concise, then I think we could stick with basic living expenses. But again, wouldn't hurt this court to use similar language that we also see in the model rule as well. I believe I've covered all the points that were raised earlier. So like I said, the committee looks at this, certainly before my time at least, and felt in some way they saw this perhaps coming in an opinion that they issued many years ago where sort of just reflecting modesty, right, above all else, is this is not a way to now start funneling money. And certainly that's not the intent behind this. But I think even back then the committee saw this as an open question under Nevada law. And at that time, I think there was less states that were doing this. And we've seen more states adopt a humanitarian exception since then. So the committee is certainly in favor of the exception with some of the commentary that we've offered in our letter here today. If the justices have any question, I'd be happy to answer them.
Yeah, so would a public defender, be considered a legal, well, I guess it would be nonprofit, so to speak, but a legal service provider? Does a public defender fit under here?
I think you would argue yes, because they're not charging a fee for that person's service. But see, then we run into a scenario where the indigency and whether that person would be placed if they went through legal aid, now that would be an open question, right? So I think perhaps the way the rule is written, that wouldn't be clear, at least from the language of the rule as I see it.
And this rule would only apply to financial assistance delivered directly from the lawyer, correct? So for instance, a legal aid provider directing somebody to services where they can get rental assistance or get those things certainly would not run afoul of this rule.
Right. This is speaking, there's really very few rules under the rules of professional conduct that speak to like law firms or mm-hmm. organizations, right? This rule is directly to the lawyer. And so that's why I think similar like companies like Uber, you're not worried about that because we're only speaking to what the attorney can do.
Okay, thank you. Justice Pickering?
Yeah, I am also focused on the draft Model Rule 1.8, which does seem to apply, you attached it to your letter, or
yes,
your colleague did, to a lawyer representing an indigent client pro bono, comma, a lawyer representing an indigent client pro bono through a nonprofit legal services or public interest organization. And they don't have an Oxford comma, but they should. and a lawyer representing an indigent client pro bono through a law school clinical or pro bono program may provide, et cetera. So they embrace in the draft the three different categories, and we're proposing to limit it to the second, which is through a nonprofit legal service provider, but also not the public service organization. And I wonder what the experience has been elsewhere. That, including all three categories, didn't seem problematic in the discussion, and I'm not a deep student of this, but what you forwarded was helpful, and it caught my eye, and I question why we would limit it to legal service provider in this setting, because the requirement is the client be indigent and so on. So I'm not sure that it's rife for potential abuse, and if there's been problems in other states with not limiting it to supervised legal services providers.
I would be in favor of this language. I mean, it's lengthier, but I think it can also give clarity on who we're covering, right? So I think if you look at the language of the model rule, starts out representing an indigent client pro bono. So I think if you stop there, you now know that's your private placement attorney, right? I think, as I understand it from some of the comments today, comma, a lawyer representing an indigent client pro bono through a nonprofit legal services. Because it sounds like they don't view themselves as pro bono, you could almost just take those two words out, right? But then say, representing an indigent client through a nonprofit legal services or public interest organization. And now you're covering sort of the in-house people at legal aid centers who are on staff, but they're still representing an indigent client who, again, they're not paying. So I think the pro bono is in that spectrum. And then Oxford comma, that should be there. Lawyer representing an indigent client through a law school, clinical, or pro bono program. You know, I think you could likewise take the words pro bono out. If we have people at the Boyd School of Law, where I graduate from proudly, representing people through legal aid or other programs, right? If pro bono throws us off, then I think we can remove that. And then we're sort of covering the different categories of attorneys that I think we're intending to cover.
But has it been problematic to allow lawyers who are not affiliated with a pro or working under the auspices of a legal services provider? Has it been problematic where an individual lawyer is providing free representation for somebody who's indigent? Has the operation of the rule been a problem? Do you know?
I think there's virtually no disciplinary decisions in this arena, at least from that perspective.
Yeah.
I can't think of one, at least over the last 10, 15 years, where our bar has actively pursued attorneys for violations of this rule. Because I think the violations that you would see are beyond what we're discussing today, the types of gifts or financial assistance that we'd be seeing. The ABA did speak to, as they went through this, you know, there was three or four instances around the country where people were disciplined for giving modest gifts to people, which sort of triggered this. So I know we don't have Dan Hoagie here today to tell us how the bar would see this. I know they're busy enough. I don't see them as a practical matter chasing pro bono attorneys, but it's important to have language in place so that you know you're doing something that the rule allows, right? But I think practically speaking, I don't know that there's been a lot of problems with abuse of the rule in this context.
Yeah, I suppose it would be being clear as to the category that is the private lawyer representing someone free of charge pro bono, because sometimes that's just a non-paying client.
And sometimes I have those even if we didn't start out pro bono.
Yeah, exactly. But thank you for your comments.
Yes.
Thank you, Chief.
Yes, Justice Kish.
Okay.
So thank you for your presentation. Sure. I do appreciate you being present today and sort of adding more information for us to consider. But I guess here's my question. To the extent that we're focused on nonprofit legal services providers, which I understood as the civil legal services providers that are the five authorized under Access to Justice Commission. That's how I understood what we were. That's what the proposal covers. But my question is, if to the extent, say, Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada is putting out flyers so that people know if they're facing an eviction, this is a potential source of help,
why wouldn't they be able to put on their flyer, you know, we can help you with transportation if that's an obstacle? Why would it not be appropriate to allow them to put that on a flyer? And I'm asking that obviously because I think some of these proposed restrictions would preclude from telling them, look, you know, like, don't just give up and say, I can't contact legal aid because how the heck am I going to get there? Like, they might want to let people know, no, this is a service we might be able to help you with.
Yeah, no, and it's a fair point. And I guess in some ways there's a lawyer that stands behind that advertisement at legal aid, so they'd have to. So pushing out that advertisement in some ways, even if it's not you directly, you're responsible for it. So you could see that as violating this rule if we start allowing legal aid, at least as the restrictions are set forth here. So candidly, that's not a discussion that the committee had as a whole. Some of this, I think, is driven from people before us who decided to do some of this research and felt that these were appropriate restrictions. But at the same time, Nevada doesn't always follow verbatim what the ABA does.
Sure. I mean, I guess I would say I definitely understand why we had the rule to start with, right? But I think that limiting it to the specific context of legal aid providers who have restrictions of their own that govern what they do may be enough of a restriction to avoid some of the concerns. But obviously that doesn't mean you have to agree.
Oh, no. And I think certainly from like the attorneys at legal aid, they're going to view that as an impediment in some ways to people who don't choose to pursue pro bono representation because I can't get there. Don't expect me to be in court, right? Those sorts of things. Whereas the private placement attorneys, we may view that differently because, again, we sort of feel comfort in knowing, you know, advertisements coming from legal aid, ensuring their mission and pursuing their objectives. Whereas the attorneys that the cases are placed with, again, I assume that too. But you can see that a little bit differently because that's their own advertisements that they handle themselves, submitted to the advertising committee. So to the extent the court looks at perhaps breaking apart or adding categories, that might be something worth looking at, distinguishing who could advertise.
And sorry, just hopefully a quick question because time is getting away from us. But to the extent, and of course, we're aware the Legal Aid Center represents a lot of children through their Children's Attorney Project. You're not the bar counsel, but is it the view of the standing committee that there would be a cause for concern if they were to have, you know, a Halloween party for their Children's Attorney Project clients and give them, you know, some candy and a mask or something? Would that be a problem?
So the answer to that is no, right? And I think that's the counterpoint for constricting gifts to living expenses. I think if it's undefined, though, then you can apply that as far-fetched as your imagination can be. You know, and look, at the end of the day, the rules are rules of reason. We know that. That's set forth in 1.0A. And so in many ways, the court could say, well, look, you're all smart. You're attorneys. And if we see something come down and we know that that goes beyond what we intended, then the court could certainly take that up on a, you know, on a case-by-case basis.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. On that same point, though, you know, my concern about limiting it to basic living expenses is along that same line. Like, let's say there's a CAP attorney that has a 16-year-old girl that needs a dress to go to homecoming. You know, it just seems like those kinds of things can make all the difference in the world to a kid, even if it's, you know, a modest expense to the lawyer and the lawyer's willing to do that. If we're going to change this rule, should we preclude things like that?
Yeah, and I think, you know, as lawyers, we're not trying to inhibit charitable contributions, right? I mean, that would be counterproductive to what we do, especially in the pro bono context. So it's a fair point that's not something that you would probably consider a basic living expense, right? A dress or tickets for prom, certainly not, but it could make all the difference for, you know,
you must not have any teenage daughters.
Not yet. She's 8. She's close. But,
wait till she gets there. She's going to consider that a living expense.
I'm fearful of that day. So I I don't have the answer to that. Of course, I have to leave it to people smarter than us here at the committee to make those kind of tough decisions. So I think I would say if you didn't use the language, I think the court would be comforted in knowing that because these are rules of reason, that if people abuse them, you know, they'll have their own problems.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
Any other speakers in Las Vegas? Okay, seeing none. Justice Perry-Gary, are there any speakers in Carson City?
We have some attendees here. Anybody want to speak? Nope, they're all shaking their head no.
Okay, excellent. All right, then at this time, unless there's anything further from my colleagues, we'll take this item under submission. And we'll now open 80KT0611 in the matter of the adoption of Supreme Court Rule 49.5. I'll turn this over to my colleague, Justice Kadish, at this time.
Thanks, Chief. So this is a proposed Supreme Court Rule 49.5, and this also came out of discussions at the Access to Justice Commission. You know, the groups and organizations, the individuals who are part of the commission are, you know, actually our goal is to try to facilitate, as the name would imply, access to justice. And so we were talking about what things can we do to help facilitate a pipeline of people who would be perhaps become ultimately employees with legal services organizations, or at least firm up their commitment to pro bono assistance if they don't actually go work for legal services providers. And we already have in place Supreme Court Rule 49.1, which is different. It allows folks who are barred in other states to come in for limited periods of time, or at least for some categories, limited periods of time. And that would include legal services organization as well as DAs and PDs in rural counties. We have that rule. And that's people who are barred in other states. We also have Rule 49.3, which allows law students to work for government or nonprofit organizations with, of course, restrictions and supervision while they are law students. This proposed Rule 49.5 is kind of filling a gap in between. So someone who's no longer a student and has graduated, but is still trying to pass the Nevada bar. And one of the restrictions that we have in the proposed rule does require that there's someone intending to be a member of the Nevada bar, that at least for some limited period of time while attempting to pass the bar, that they be permitted to work at the legal services organizations. And I should add that subsequently I was contacted and had several conversations with Marcy Reba on behalf of the State Department of Indigent Defense Services, and she asked if we would be willing to amend the proposed rule to also add, similar to these other rules that I announced, that it would also encompass DA and PD offices in the rural jurisdictions. We then, I filed an amendment to the petition that would include that. But I want to go over some of the restrictions that we have, because I, like many probably commenters and other people, might have some concerns about what are we doing here for folks who have not yet passed the bar. So let me say this. There are restrictions to only folks. It's only for up to two tries at passing the bar exam. If they have failed to pass after two tries, they're no longer permitted to practice under this proposed rule, right? So it's not an unending thing where this can go on forever. And also to that point, it also expires automatically 18 months after the law school graduation. So 18 months after, or failure to pass after two attempts at the Nevada bar exam. Of course, it also would not apply to folks who are not being admitted to the Nevada bar for any reason other than the failure to pass the exam. And also, I would note that the rule specifies the supervision of another attorney, of a licensed attorney who's been licensed for multiple years here in Nevada. It's limited to the legal aid organizations or, as proposed, DA or PD offices in the rural jurisdictions. And that supervising attorney's license is pretty much on the line, and the rule makes that clear as well. So that is the proposal. We had a subcommittee of the Access to Justice Commission that had several discussions about this. We worked on the rule, then we presented it to Access to Justice, then we went back and worked on it some more and came up with a proposal, then the proposed amendment. But I have read the public comments we got, which were, I believe, all in support of it. Some would propose going beyond rural jurisdictions, potentially to Washoe County. We had a couple of suggestions and other things, but I'm interested to hear public comment today. So thanks, Chief, for the opportunity to present this today and hear any public comment here in person.
All right, thank you, Justice Kadish. Would you like to be heard on this item in Las Vegas? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Stiglitz and honorable members of the Supreme Court. My name is Shay Dignan, and I'm a recent graduate of William S. Boyd School of Law, and I'm now a staff attorney at Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada. Prior to becoming a staff attorney at Legal Aid Center, I served as the Community Justice Fellow there, which is a full-time postgraduate position. During my fellowship, I participated in research and drafting of Rule 49.5, and I was on the subcommittee with Justice Kadish. Rule 49.5 allows law school graduates who are preparing to take the bar exam or waiting for their results to engage in the limited restricted practice that we've allowed students to engage in for some years now under 49.3 under the license of their supervising attorney. It's modeled after Rule 49.3, and the language is the same. The certification is also very time limited, as Justice Kadish said. 18 months upon after graduation from law school, or after they learned that they failed their second bar exam. So as a student at Boyd, I engaged in limited practice under Rule 49.3. If 49.5 had been in place, I would have been able to continue the same thing I was doing as a law student while I waited for the results of my bar exam, and that would be the second bar exam. So I didn't pass the Nevada exam until May of this year, but that would have been 9 months I was working at Legal Aid Center full-time anyway, that I could have been doing what I'd been previously doing under 49.3 when I was a student in similar activities. I'd like to share an observation that solidified how real and present that the access to justice gap is in Las Vegas and in Nevada right now. During my first few weeks at Legal Aid Center, I observed the trial and litigation prep class that we offer as a free class to the community. And the attorney who was giving it started the slideshow, and it was a presentation about how to represent yourself in a trial pro se about child custody. And I was shocked. There was about 8 people in the room and about over 20 online, definitely. And I thought, could there really be this many people representing themselves pro se in something as important as child custody case? And there absolutely is all the time in this community. To give you an idea of how many unrepresented litigants there are, numbers-wise, the Civil Law Self-Help Center is currently serving 350 to 400 people a day. And according to the most recent legal needs assessment prepared for the Nevada Supreme Court's Access to Justice Commission, 76% of the total number of legal problems that low-income Nevadans face are not being addressed. Due to lack of capacity by legal aid service providers. This means that 3 out of 4 low-income Nevadans who seek to protect their families, their homes, and their livelihoods in a legal crisis are doing so on their own without legal assistance of anyone licensed or with a traditional legal education, which is what the practitioners would have under 49.5. Imagine how much of a difference a recent law school graduate could have made for the people in that trial prep and litigation class. Also somebody who has the capacity and the time to prep for something like that all day. I was a full-time employee, that's what those practitioners would be. This is why we're advocating for the adoption of Rule 49.5. It's a tool to expand quality legal representation in this community in Nevada and bridge the access to justice gap. Before I turn it over to my colleague, Taylor Altman, who was also on the subcommittee and involved in the drafting, I do have to say I practice almost exclusively in eviction court right now, and the need for assistance for legal aid clients is dire at the moment, and this would really make a huge difference. So I'm going to turn it over to Taylor Altman. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Stiglitz and the honorable members of this court. For the record, my name is Taylor Altman, and I've served as a staff attorney at Legal Aid Center for the past 4 years. I had the honor of working with Justice Kadish and other legal aid providers in developing this rule. As Shane mentioned, family court litigation is an area where there's an unmet need for legal representation. In consumer and housing law, there are many unrepresented litigants and few attorneys. Eviction court often feels like a battle between David and Goliath, the unrepresented tenant up against a corporate landlord. While Legal Aid Center helps thousands of litigants every year, we recognize that a staggering number are still in need of legal services. Because we don't have enough attorneys to meet this need, we unfortunately have to turn away some individuals with meritorious cases. That's why this limited practice rule is so critical. As a consumer rights attorney, I can handle up to 80 cases at a time, and some of my colleagues can, depending on practice area, handle even more. If several law school students or several law school graduates were to come and work for us while awaiting their bar results, that's many more cases that we'd be able to take on and provide more service to the community. Just as importantly, the new practitioners will gain experience and training under the supervision of a seasoned attorney and will be better prepared to represent clients once they're licensed. The rule would also incentivize more law school graduates to work for legal aid organizations if they knew they could gain a head start on representing clients before having passed the bar exam. New lawyers receiving training through supervised certification programs is now a national best practice that this rule promotes. Many states, up to as many as 15, are implementing or have already implemented similar rules, including Alaska, Arizona, Georgia, and Idaho. Except for some increased supervision needs, the rule would require no major changes to our client representation model. Legal Aid Center has already established training and supervision practices that will support effective representation by these law graduates. So, for example, we have opportunities for them to shadow experienced attorneys, receive mentorship, observe court proceedings, complete CLEs through our office, and even participate in the Attorney Training Academy, which is a comprehensive program that introduces these attorneys to every facet of our organization. Once the supervised practitioners are trained, they can begin providing essential legal services to the community. Each client that a legal aid provider takes on is one who doesn't have to navigate the often Byzantine court system alone. Simply expecting licensed attorneys to fill the gap in a pro bono capacity is not a sustainable model. Instead, placing law graduates into the legal aid workforce has been shown to be much more effective. Graduates with 3 years of law school under their belts are an untapped resource for assisting people in our community that can't afford an attorney. For many low-income Nevadans who struggle to meet their legal needs, time is running out to protect their legal rights, and that's why we urge the adoption of Supreme Court Rule 49.5.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Speaker? No, okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
I have a question,
Chief. Yes, Your Honor.
Now, in your mind, would the trial court have asked, because in Section 7 on compensation, we use the term attorney's fees, request a court for attorney's fees. And you know, when the trial courts are asked to assess fees in a given case, there are defined categories: attorney rates, paralegal rates, process server, expert witness, etc. We're not really dealing with attorney's fees here. And my concern is using the word attorney's fees kind of imparts to the court that maybe we should use an attorney kind of analysis as opposed to what we're dealing with here, which is non-licensed practitioners. I'm not saying we need to come up with a rate today for what that person should be, but I don't know if maybe it would be more appropriate to just replace attorney there with supervised legal practitioner in some fashion. That kind of the trial court's going to have to create how they assess fees for that particular person. But I wouldn't want the courts to feel like I need to apply an attorney rate to what the work was being done in a particular case.
Your Honor, I think that's an excellent point. I think also the supervised practitioner, it's important to remember, is not going to ask for or receive any compensation from the client themselves, and neither is Legal Aid Center or the other legal service providers. This would only be to get attorney's fees or in this case, supervised legal practitioner fees, whatever the rate may be as determined, you know, perhaps under the Brunzell test, what is reasonable. And this also goes into the limited scope of this rule because we don't seek compensation from the clients. It would just be any attorney's fees or compensation for that supervised legal practitioner's time would go back to the organization so that we can help even more clients.
Sure. And I think it's probably going to be appropriate in a great many cases to get fees, but how we couch it, I think, might be important. So, yeah. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there any other speakers here in Las Vegas? All right, seeing none. Justice Perry-Gary, are there any speakers on this ADKT in Carson City?
Yeah, I see some heads nodding affirmatively, so come on up.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Marcy Reba, and I serve as the Executive Director for the Department of Indigent Defense Services. Before I begin, I wanted to thank this court and Justice Kadish, as well as the Access to Justice Commission, allowing this amendment to be offered. And we agree with Justice Kadish that this could possibly offer a possible pipeline into Indigent Defense Services work or into public defender offices. At this point in time, we have a nationwide shortage of public defenders, and it's really hitting home in our rural counties. To add to that, the state of Nevada has entered into a stipulated consent judgment where the department is undergoing a workload study, which is expected to be released in the next month. Once that is released, counties have a year to comply with the number of attorneys that are needed for those rural areas. And we expect that there to be a significant increase in the amount of attorneys that are needed there. Allowing graduates to work in those offices will create that pipeline where we can immediately hire them upon their release or graduation from school and start them working under the appropriate supervision. Just showing directly how this could work, under Rule 49.3, we were able to offer an externship opportunity for law students to go to our rural public defender offices. One of our externs is now currently working. He's graduated law school, and he's currently working at one of our rural county offices, but he's no longer able to practice law under that limited practice exception of 49.3. He's simply working as a law clerk. So if we were able to adopt Supreme Court Rule 49.5 with the amendment, that would allow that attorney to start practicing as a lawyer immediately upon his graduation and employment and that appropriate supervision. So we are here to speak in support. We've also had letters from Nikki Harris and Don Nielsen from the law school to express their support. We believe that attorneys going into public interest is very important for our state of Nevada, and we hope that you support this proposal. Thank you.
May I ask a question, Ms. Reba?
Yes, of course.
I can see you. I guess I should ask her. Do you mind if I ask you a question?
No. Yeah. Yes.
So something I'm concerned about, obviously in the indigent defense arena, we have a huge need out in the rurals. Like I attended last week a conference on legal deserts And if our rural situation and indigent offense doesn't qualify as legal desert, I don't know what does. My concern with this is the place we need it the most is a place where we don't have, we wouldn't have the institutional guardrails or supervision that, say, a legal aid provider has when they have a whole stable of attorneys in an office, or public defenders like Washoe County. I saw a letter from Mr. Picker from the Alternate Defender's Office, where you have some sort of institution set up that can help assist and provide support and supervision, which is contemplated by the rule, for that that person who's pending their licensure. So I was just curious if you had any. We have a lot to talk about here and to consider on this, and I don't want it to detract from the fact that I recognize that's where we need it the most, you know, out in that context. But how are we going to supervise these individuals when we're sending them out to these legal deserts without the kind of guardrails of an established office, if that makes any sense?
That does make sense. And I believe that there is supervision in those rural counties. You know, things are changing in our rurals as they're looking at their indigent defense services and deciding how they want to provide those services. Churchill County, for example, historically relied upon contract attorneys and has changed their model into an organized public defender office. Elko County is an organized public defender office, and at this point in time, they are facing an extreme shortage in public defenders. I believe they have 2 to 3 openings in their office, and they're conflicting off of 40% of their cases. The majority of the cases they're conflicting off of are the Category A and B felonies, because what they're filling their office with is, you know, the younger attorneys that they're training to bring them in. So there is that supervised oversight, and it's needed in the rural counties that have the organized office. And I think the rule is limited to those areas with the organized offices. Of course, if this court would like the department to help provide oversight of students, if that's a possibility, that's something that we could look into. We do provide resources and oversight for the rural counties, but what we're really looking at and where we really find the need are those organized offices with leadership that are having problems filling their salaried positions. The one-off attorneys where they can contract with attorneys, those generally are not open for a long period of time. Those are easier for those counties to fill because they're independent attorneys that are contracting with those services. They are qualified to take those positions, but where we are really seeing the struggle is in those organized offices.
All right, thank you. Justice Kadish?
Thank you, Chief. Building on what Ms. Reba just said, the proposed amendment as it relates to indigent defense in criminal matters would apply to those supervised legal practitioners employed by the state public defender or the county equivalent of such an office to practice in a county with fewer than 100,000. So I think it's limited to only an established public defender type office for a given county or the state PD office. I also wanted to mention, and this applies, I guess, across the board, was that as to the supervised, the attorney supervising the supervised legal practitioners, they would each have a maximum of 2 supervised legal practitioners at any given time to make sure they don't, you know, they're not trying to run 10 people out and perhaps not have as close supervision as we'd like. So I hope those will help, but certainly those legal deserts are a concern to many of us. So thanks, Ms. Reba. I don't have anything else.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have another speaker, Chief.
Good afternoon, Justices. May it please the Court. My name is Evie Grosnick, and I am the Washoe County Public Defender. First, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to provide a letter as well as speak to you today about my support of this amendment. I do want to start with the fact that I support the rule in its original form. First and foremost, many of our public defender clients and their families also rely on these legal services that are available in our community. And in Northern Nevada, we do see a shortage there as well. And so I think that the court is really on the right track of addressing, trying to help the most people who need it the most by offering this rule. Second, on top of that, I do support the amendment that Ms. Reba proposed regarding indigent defense in rural counties. It is well documented and well understood that those are legal deserts, and there is nowhere that that need is greater. I think that Justice Kadish said it best in the petition in stating that what the goal is to increase access to justice by building a pipeline, and that is what this rule would allow. I have seen our organization, as well as local organizations, lose individuals in between that time of taking the bar and finding out whether they passed or not, because they simply cannot commit to stay in a jurisdiction. They want to get their feet on the ground. They want to be, you know, usually doing some kind of legal work, so that there's not that hole in their resume. So I think this is a really important rule. I would encourage you to adopt the amendment that expands this to rural public defense as well. I don't want to take away anything from the rurals. I agree that that is the direst need, as well as legal organizations, but I do want to let you know that Washoe County does struggle to attract new attorneys called to public defense. And I say that because I think, as many of you know, public defense is not just a job or just a profession for a lot of us, it's a calling. And so you really tend to attract people who have deep empathy for our clients and who care a lot about serving these vulnerable populations. So I hope that at some point the committee would consider including Washoe County in these amendments, both for 49.5 and potentially as well as to 49.1E, which is the rule that allows limited practice certification attorneys to if they're admitted in another jurisdiction for a very limited period of time. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Krosnick. Does anybody have any questions? Nope. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we got a few more here, Chief.
Good afternoon, Justices. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Vincent Guthrow. I serve as the Executive Director for the Nevada Association of Counties. And just allow me to share a few remarks that were approved by our board last week. On behalf of the Nevada Association of Counties Board of Directors, we thank you for the introduction of this amendment with the amendment, and we are fully supportive of the adoption of this proposed rule with the amendment. Every county in Nevada provides for public defense of indigent persons. As you know, in Nevada, counties fund an agreed upon portion for these services, with the state of Nevada funding any additional mandates or costs to deliver public defense. Having an adequate and robust public defense system is crucial to the delivery of fair and equitable justice and meeting the goal of equal treatment under the law. However, currently, all levels of government, especially in our rural counties, are suffering from a critical shortage of professionals that can be employed in these public interest areas. This proposed rule change, with the amendment proposed, could assist in increasing the pipeline of eager professionals interested in public service. It would be a welcomed recruitment tool for helping rural counties staff their district attorney and public defender offices. So with that, I just wanted to be short and share our support and the NACO Board of Directors' support for this. I'm happy to answer any questions if there are any, but thank you for the time.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Mark Jackson, Douglas County District Attorney, and I'm here speaking as president of the Nevada District Attorneys Association. It's not often that the prosecution and the defense bar stands before this court united on an issue, but this is one of those instances. the crisis with respect to recruiting competent and ethical attorneys to come into the criminal justice system to work for a public defender's office or prosecutor's office is really something that both sides are feeling at this time. Most of the rural DA's offices that have had vacancies for prosecutor positions have had those vacancies open for a very lengthy period of time. In Douglas County, I have one position that's been open since November of 2022 and one position since June of 2023. So any tools that can be given to the rural prosecutors as well as the rural public defenders in order to fill these much needed positions, we'd be very thankful for.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Jackson.
Chief, I think that's all we've got here in Carson.
All right, thank you, Justice Perry-Gary. All right. Great. Justice Kadish, do you have something else?
No, Chief. I think we've all got some food for thought to consider. Thank you.
All right, then at this time, ADK.